The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So, good morning. This is the second week of a series, but don't worry if you weren't here for last week, because this one will work by itself also. And what we're talking about is two qualities of the mind, two practices that we develop that the Buddha said were very important in the process of awakening, and these two are called serenity and insight. In fact, there's a sutta that says, these two things pertain to true knowledge. What two? Serenity and insight. And the Pali words for these in the ancient Indian language are shamatha and vipassana. And so you may recognize, you may have heard those words before, and if you haven't, don't worry. But we'll be talking more about insight today. But I want to start with a kind of an image or a story. So imagine that there are two people walking up a hill together, okay? And one is using the walk to become very intimate with the walking process, very kind of absorbing her mind into the movements of walking, letting go of thoughts and feelings, just fully immersing herself in the walking experience. And then the other person is also walking quietly, and his mind too becomes calm and stable in this walking. But at the top, the first person continues to stay absorbed in the inner experience, you know, fully feeling the bliss of her gathered mind, and maybe even more gathered now that she stopped walking and can really sit very still. And the second also feels the pleasure of this tranquility of stopping, but becomes interested in the amazing view that can be seen from the top of the hill, right? And so he surveys the landscape with sharp eyes, instantly attuning to and recognizing all the activity that's happening in the valley below. And because his mind is calm from having, you know, walked mindfully up the hill, he's able to see very clearly what's happening there. So this image or story is somewhat analogous, I think, to the different modes of meditation that we're talking about, serenity and insight. So the journey up the hill is not so very different for the two people, right? In terms of what's needed, both needed effort, mindfulness, intention, patience, confidence, many of the qualities that we talk about in practice. But the aim of the mind was different, right? And the result was different at the top. And so I think this, well, we'll see how this evolves through the course of today, but that image came to mind as one that kind of matches the way these relate. So here's a quote from a teacher. Tranquility meditation is the foundation for insight practice, providing the requisite stability of mind to allow the awareness that is peculiar to insight meditation to arise. So I liked that quote because of this word peculiar. what does this mean? You know, what is peculiar about this awareness that's related to insight meditation? So today we're going to move from talking about shamatha, or serenity, like we did last week, to talking about vipassana, more insight meditation, and also an exploration of both of them together as the path to awakening. Just like that first quote said, these two things pertain to true knowledge. They're both needed. They're both important. So first I want to give some top-level, you know, a framework for the instructions around insight practice that you may have heard at various times at this center or on retreats or others. So one quality that's important for what we call insight practice is investigation. And you may remember that for, or you can learn now, that for serenity practice, generally there isn't a lot of investigation. And investigation means kind of going into the function of the mind, the way the mind is functioning at that moment, the way things are unfolding. For example, if the mind gets distracted in concentration meditation, generally the aim is to simply come back. You say, oh, not on the object anymore, and just return, kind of simply. Whereas in insight practice, we might say, oh, wow, how did that thought unfold? You know, what does it feel like to be distracted? What is happening in my mind? Is there a particular way that thinking feels now that I'm lost in thought, or I had just been lost in thought? Those kinds of things. So I'll even dare to say the word thinking. Thought and thinking is allowed in insight practice. Not discursive thought, you know, the kind of thoughts that we usually go off on. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that she said that yesterday, and what am I going to do about that, and how am I going to solve this problem? I know the mind likes to do that. My mind does that too, quite frequently, because that's what we practice a lot of the time. So this is a different kind of thinking. Sometimes we give it a different word in investigation just so it doesn't sound like discursive thought. We might say contemplation, something like that. But basically there is thinking involved. There is this kind of investigation of experience. Serenity practice came about. Serenity of mind comes about through continuous mindfulness, and that is still employed in Vipassana practice. But it's now used in a different way. It's used to see clearly the things in the mind that arise and pass and how they arise and pass. Yeah? So it's important to orient the mind properly for insight practice. I remember there was one time that we were talking about concentration in a small group session with a teacher who is a practitioner of concentration, and one student was relating with enthusiasm her sense of concentration that she had while looking at the floor plan that she was helping to design for an organization that she works with, and that she could become very meditatively absorbed in thinking about the floor plan and thinking about all the different ways that things were going to be used and what it was going to look like and all these details. Which are, by the way, very good things to think about. There's nothing wrong with that kind of thinking. But the teacher was trying to make a point and said, well, that is a valid kind of concentration, but you should be aware that there are different results from that type compared to the type that's developed in meditation. One of them leads to a great floor plan, and the other leads to liberation from suffering. So, you know, you don't have to take this too seriously, but I think it's indicative that there's an importance to how we're using the mind at a given time. And we have to use our mind in a lot of different ways to live, obviously. So there are many instructions about how to orient the mind for contemplation, for insight. The most well-known in our tradition is what's called the Satipatthana Sutta. And this describes four establishments or foundations of mindfulness, four areas of experience of which to be aware, as well as how to be aware of them. In terms of the how, the sutta says, the mind is to be ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So what that means is the covetousness and grief, maybe is what we can zero in on. If we have those, those are the forces that cause the mind to start thinking about the past, the future, our concerns, our worries, our regrets. All those things that agitate the mind come about because we have not put away covetousness and grief for the world for that time period. You know, we let go of that during meditation. And then the four areas of experience that we generally pay attention to are the body, feeling tone, mind, and mind objects. I won't go into a lot of detail on that. But this tells us very broadly, gives us instructions on, you know, what is it out of this whole amazing range of things that we experience? Where's a good place to focus our attention and in what way? There are a lot of other teachings that talk about ways to undertake Vipassana practice also. The Anapanasati Sutta, which is about mindfulness of breathing in particular, describing 16 steps of contemplating the breath, not in terms of discursive thought, but again in terms of training the mind into, in this particular case, a state of concentration and then into observing certain aspects of the breath. So what aspects, you know, what is it that we're looking at in this peculiar kind of awareness? And one thing that we're asked to look at is change. The changing nature of experience is one of the most important and most profound things that we can look at. You might say, so what? I know that things change. Everything in my life is changing all the time in ways that I don't want it to, and that's the challenge. But something actually just about noticing the arising and passing of experience helps the mind to let go of its fixation with experience being a certain way or with keeping experience from changing. And that's actually the beginning of freedom for the mind. We are also asked to contemplate the unsatisfactoriness of experience. So again, many people think they already get this coming into practice because things in my life aren't going well or everything's wrong or something. But the Buddha is pointing to something deeper here, to the understanding that actually precisely because everything is changing, everything has the potential to be different than it is, I can't provide a lasting satisfaction to us. No given thing can do it for us forever. And that is not at all, I'll immediately say, that's not at all to say that nothing is worthwhile, that there can't be very meaningful things in life, and there can't be things that are worth protecting and keeping in our lives. There can be all of those things. But we can at least begin to grasp that all the conditions of our life are going to change, and to prepare the mind for really understanding that deeply. Because when we don't, that's really when the suffering can happen. So we've talked about impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. There's kind of a third one with this set, which is that we're asked to notice that there isn't anything that we can reliably label as our lasting, everlasting, true self. And I mean, what could it be? I wish I could sit here and tell you, point to one thing that is Kim, you know, that you can really identify as me. But, you know, can it be my body? Well, I know, actually, my body's quite different than it was earlier, and it will be much different later. As a tiny example, I had very short hair for 8.5 years, and I have recently grown it out, and I look completely different. But you wouldn't believe how surprised people are when they see me and they haven't seen the change yet. So definitely my hair is not me. That I've got. But, you know, what about my emotions? I know those change on a daily basis, if not an hourly or minutely basis sometimes. My thoughts, I don't even remember everything I was thinking yesterday, but it was useful at the time, maybe. And even my beliefs, those last a little longer, my views, my beliefs, my values. But even there, I can see change over time, or deepening, or seeing different aspects. I'm aware that they're brought about by conditions in my life. So I don't know. I don't know what I could tell you is the everlasting true me. But that's not, of course, to deny that there's an experience of being a person. I experience that. I suspect all of you do, too. And there is certainly a logic and a pattern to the unfolding of my experience. There are things about my body that unfold in a certain way. I'm not going to suddenly change skin color. There could be ways that could happen. Boy, even that. So, you know, we should question just how absolute our idea of ourself is. So these three ideas, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and what's called not-self, or anicca, dukkha, and anatta, are said to be three qualities that are common to our experience as humans. And as we see them again and again, and we are going to have to see them a lot of times, as we see them again and again, they have the power eventually to uproot the ignorance that causes us to act in ways that brings suffering. So we start to see things, to use more normal language, common language, we start to see things as they really are, which is changing. They're changing. They're not the same. This is insight. You know, we don't have to see insight as something really remote, and we're going to have it someday when we've done lots and lots of retreats, and or maybe a few lifetimes from now. Really, we can have quite important insights just through being willing to notice things arise and pass, and how the mind relates to that, how the mind deals with that. There was a time in my life when there was a big change. I was an athlete for the early part of my life. That was very meaningful to me, to exercise my body, to feel the strength, the life flowing through it. I didn't see it this way, but it was probably kind of a spiritual practice for me. And then I had a period where my body became ill for a number of years, and that was just not possible to be able to exercise in that way. Certainly the identity of athlete, as I had known it, fell away. And that was big suffering for me. I was not aware to what degree my mind had attached to that identity. I had no idea that had occurred. And so when there was this disruption, then there was a lot of suffering, a lot of dukkha. And so I wanted to do something about that. That was actually when I started practicing. I said, there's got to be some other way to get a handle on this. And what I learned, what I began to learn through practice, and this is the nature of Vipassana, is I began to learn how the mind worked. I began to learn that this is what the mind does. It finds something that's meaningful, and then it grabs onto that and says, this is me. This is what I need to be happy. This is not something that we do consciously. I didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write down the 10 things that I'm attached to today, and one of them is that I'm an athlete. That never was any conscious decision by some committee somewhere. But it happened. Why? Because this is actually how the mind operates. This is what it does. And it's doing this in the background somewhere. And I have become humbled. I became humbled by that experience and by ongoing seeing the ways in which my mind attaches, such that I want to see when that process is occurring. I want to understand that in order that I don't get caught like that. Now, that's not my only motivation for practicing. I'm framing it as a story that way. There's many, many other things happening. But definitely, when I began to see what my mind had already done in the background in the first part of my life, I was really motivated to learn about what that is, because we got dumped this technology, of our mind sort of got dumped on us, and we didn't get an instruction manual. And this is a chance to figure out how it works and not to be caught by the bugs, because they aren't really bugs. They're just places where the mind isn't seeing clearly. So we can uproot those things. So these analytical practices of figuring out how the mind works are crucial for liberating insight. It's not all about just calming the mind and attaining a blissful state. And if you have trouble with concentration, don't worry about it. You can always do insight practice. It's available all the time to look at how the mind is working. But let me talk for a moment now about concentration practice, what we talked about last week, but in light of what we're talking about now, in light of the framework that we're talking about now. So you may recall that I said that serenity or concentration practice produces highly pleasurable states. This is the bliss of meditation that you hear about. And the mind can really drink in this wholesome pleasure for a long time if it gets to a point where it can become gathered and focused and concentrated in that way. Some teachers will claim that any enjoyment of the pleasure of concentration is an early warning sign of attachment and should be immediately interrupted, basically. You'll actually hear this. I can't agree with this. I think it's fine, actually, for the mind to drink of that wholesomeness, even for quite a while, so long as the person is also listening to teachings on insight and liberation. As long as that's the case, then the mind is very likely to eventually be able to turn away from just the concentration and start investigating again. It takes some wisdom to turn away from that kind of pleasure, but the mind truly intent on freedom is going to do that. Another reason that it's okay to enjoy concentration is that actually I think the mind is often simultaneously developing insight. I don't know how easy it is to only do concentration practice, because at least for my mind, in order to overcome the hindrances to concentration that naturally appear, the mind has to have a sense that those are there. You have to be mindful, you have to be aware of what's arising, you have to be aware that the mind is currently getting sluggish. Oh, I'm getting off balance, I'm starting to fall asleep. What should I do? Oh, I need to find ways to raise the energy, sit up straighter, breathe more on the in-breath, pay more attention to the in-breath, or even open the eyes, or even stand up. Or if it's really extreme, stop meditating and take a nap, you know, something like that. So we have to know. We have to know what the mind is doing. And so this process of knowing, oh, my mind is in a certain state, here's what I can do to change that or to rebalance it, that's the development of insight and wisdom. So I think in order to, you know, and then when the mind does get balanced, maybe it will gather and focus and become concentrated. And so I think we have to develop a lot of wisdom just to get the concentration. This is training in causation. And actually more subtly, while we're doing that whole process of abandoning the hindrances, we are understanding that sluggishness is impermanent. Well, that's insight, you know, to know that the mind isn't always in this state. It's caused. It's caused by certain things. And when those things aren't there, the sluggishness isn't there. So wisdom is developing. And when there's enough, then the mind is ready to allow even concentration to cease. How about that? So to have equanimity about the arising and passing of that type of pleasure. So this is an important point, actually. It is said that when the light, how should I say it, that equanimity when fully developed is equanimous about whatever state the mind is in, and that includes whether the mind is concentrated or not. So if you were sitting there today and felt annoyed that you weren't getting adequately focused and gathered and getting that deep pleasure of concentration, that's a sign that there wasn't really equanimity, a complete equanimity about the state of the mind. Now, that's fine. That happens all the time. It would be very nice if we could be concentrated all the time in meditation. Sit down, the mind concentrates. Sure. But we're developing our equanimity also as we realize that that's not necessary. Concentration, too, is conditioned. Okay, so insight is said to be a counteraction to a particular issue in the mind, and that issue is ignorance. I already mentioned that a little bit earlier, but let's talk about it a little bit more. Ignorance doesn't mean that we're stupid. It means, that's the way the word is often used in our culture, but it means that we are ignoring something. We're not seeing something. Like in the case of when I wasn't aware that I was attached to being an athlete, I had no clue. I was not seeing that at all. That, you know, that cord in the mind that had formed. I didn't see that. So it's better to see than not to see. So here's from a sutta. When insight is developed, what benefit does one experience? Wisdom is developed. When wisdom is developed, what benefit does one experience? Ignorance is abandoned. So we have the pathway from vipassana practice to the development of wisdom to the abandoning of ignorance, which means being able to see things more clearly at any level, you know, to any degree. Sometimes wisdom is likened to a light. Here's one passage where that is said. Wisdom arising dispels the darkness of ignorance, produces the illumination of insight, brings forth the light of knowledge and makes manifest the noble truths. And further, the spiritual practitioner sees with complete understanding impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and corelessness. this translation uses corelessness for not self. It's the same. Wisdom is sometimes also likened to being a knife, and that's not a violent image, but more like one of cutting a plant, for example. So there's actually an image of seizing a bunch of barley in one hand and cutting it with a sickle. And that's the sickle of wisdom, cutting off attachment, in a sense. So it's wisdom that provides the power behind insight to free the mind. That's what we develop. So I've started to hint at a transition point that when one develops serenity for a while, which is totally fine, you don't have to worry about the attachment of that, but at some point there's a transition to valuing insight just as much as serenity, for example. So what, you know, what makes the qualities of mind that are called the awakening factors? I alluded to these in the last talk, so I want to mention them again. There are a set of seven factors that are called awakening factors that are said to be very strong in the mind as it approaches release. And over our lives, of course, we develop them in various ways, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and every now and then they're all there, then they fade. But these awakening factors that are considered especially important for freeing the mind are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. You don't have to memorize those. But the question is, what makes one of these qualities an awakening factor as opposed to something else or some other, because they are sometimes used in other ways in the mind. And one of them, basically, I would say that it's the aim of them. So if they are aimed in a way that leads toward letting go, that's what makes them an awakening factor. There are technical terms given in the texts about being based upon seclusion and dispassion and cessation and aiming toward release. So there are several, several ways to see that. But basically, I would say that translated into language, you know, that relates to our practice, if you sit down to concentrate the mind and begin gathering your mind, and the purpose is to attain bliss and just sit there like a chicken. There was a teacher who said if sitting was all that was needed, chickens would be enlightened. So if that's the aim, that's probably not concentration as an awakening factor, right? And so, but if you sit down with the aim of stilling the mind, what? For the purpose of seeing. If my mind were still, I could see better. Just like if the camera's on a tripod, it takes a clearer picture than if you're holding it and shaking, your arms are shaking. So it depends a little bit what the aim is and what are the supporting conditions in the mind for that concentration to be there. You know, and that's what it means by wise samadhi. I can say that, you know, we don't need to think about this and say, oh my gosh, have I set the right intention exactly? I found that a useful intention to set any time in sitting meditation or other times is, how can I see and reduce the stress in this situation? This is a view through the Four Noble Truths. So, for example, if I'm in a situation talking with somebody and I feel irritation with them arising because I don't like what they're saying or the way they're saying it, I can feel first that that causes pain to me. Oh, it doesn't feel good for me to be irritated with this person. So, you know, and then there's a variety of things that can happen at that point. But if the aim is to see the stress and to find a way to reduce it, then I'm going to take some action that's appropriate. I may tell them that the way they're saying that is hurtful to me, if that's an appropriate thing. I may speak myself and change the situation. If I can't, I may generate loving kindness in my heart. If it's a really extreme situation, I can get up and leave the room. You know, depending on the conditions, a lot of things can come about. But why did any of those happen? It's because I wanted to see the stress and find a way to reduce it in my heart. And so Now, translating this into meditation, sitting on the cushion, what if our aim was that whatever is happening in the mind, we're going to see the stress in it and find a way to let go of that? So one thing that can happen is that we sit and we realize, wow, my mind is really distracted right now, and have some compassion for a mind that's running around like that. Maybe eventually, if we, if the conditions are right, seeing stress in the way the mind is running around will eventually cause it to let go of thoughts and settle into a concentrated state. If the aim continues to be seeing the stress and letting go of it, what's going to happen? The mind's going to notice that even in a state of, say, a little bit of peace, a little bit of concentration, there's still a little bit of stress associated with, for example, thinking about the fact that the mind is a little bit concentrated. There can still be thoughts in the early stages of concentration. And then we say, you know, I don't need to think that. The mind settles more deeply. And then we notice that there's actually quite a lot of pleasure associated with concentration, and that some of it is kind of, if we really tune into it, it can get a little bit loud, like there's kind of a buzzing feeling in the body from the mind being so gathered, so high energy. And so we let go of that. We say, wow, I don't need to focus on this buzzing in the body. I'm going to reduce that. You know, the mind settles a little bit more. And so if we do have that aim, eventually the mind will realize that even the deepest concentration has some doing in it, you know, some little bit of, I wouldn't call it suffering, but a little bit of effort. What if you were really as lazy as you could be and you wanted to make no effort, no output of doing? Eventually, there's a point where that's not laziness, and that is letting go. You know, that's deep letting go. And so the mind seeking to end dukkha is not going to get stuck in concentration. It's going to find a way to become equanimous even about that doing. And then it's interesting to see what happens. Okay, so there's been lots of references in this talk and even some descriptions of what the mind does in insight practice. But I want to go back to that quote I read at the beginning. Tranquility meditation is the foundation for insight practice, providing the requisite stability of mind to allow the awareness that is peculiar to insight meditation to arise. So what is that type of awareness? Can we say anything more about it? In my experience, the awareness that is peculiar to insight meditation has a different feeling than just mindfulness, a little bit different. It's a high energy kind of attention, but the attentiveness is very stable. You know, it's high energy, but not likely to wander. Yeah, it's very interested in the present moment. And I'll just highlight one key quality that came to mind for me, and you may find that something else is prominent for you. But one of the key qualities of this attentiveness is that I find it to be deeply truthful. And what I mean by that is that it really wants to see things exactly as they are, with no conceptual or interpretive interference. There's no space in the mind for thoughts about what is happening, because what's happening is filling awareness. I don't think we have to be meditating in deep concentration for this type of awareness to arise. It's helpful to know the qualities of it so you can recognize it if it's arising. Some teachers have noted that for them, insight awareness involves contemplating with a pen and paper. You know, one teacher describes that he wrote down what he knew to be true, and he wouldn't write anything that was not absolutely true. It's not easy to do that, right? I mean, try to think of something you could write down that you know absolutely for sure. And that was a big process for him, was to realize just what he really knows to be true and how it can be expressed. Or being out in nature can also open the mind to this very truthful awareness, more than just mindfulness, with a clear unwillingness to see anything false. If it's not absolutely true, it's not worth considering. Maybe that's strong, absolutely true. We definitely don't, it's hard to know what that is. But the mind that's really intent on freedom, I think, is going to put a task like this to itself and see what happens. For other people, Vipassana contemplation focuses more on the heart qualities, you know, more on love and compassion, but again, through the eyes of wisdom. So we may contemplate, for example, the impermanence of even such beautiful states as infinite loving kindness or compassion. So really go as far as those can go and then see that, wow, that too is conditioned. One long ago monk was said to have found liberation through contemplating that even Buddhas arise and pass through the ages. We don't talk about that a lot. I don't know what belief system resonates for you, but it is said that you know, the Buddhist teachings, the availability of teachings in the world is not permanent. You know, if we didn't sit in a room like this and share them, they wouldn't continue, right? And so, and it's said that that happens, is that over time there's less and less of this, and at some point it's gone, everyone's forgotten. And then that's when a new Buddha can arise. And there have been, I don't know how many, at least a couple dozen. I didn't try to count them all. And so contemplating that even on this vast scale, the teachings arise and pass, the presence of the teachings, I guess the Dharma is still there, liberated one person's mind, you know, from attaching to anything. So there are many roads to freedom, but all of them involve deeply seeing what is actually true from the vantage point of a stable and balanced mind. This is the uprooting of ignorance, of finding out what it is that we're ignoring, what it is that we're not willing to see completely. So as a summary or a recap, the stable mind that we attain through serenity practice at any level, whether we just got a little more peaceful in today's sitting or whether we're doing the jhana practice, that mind is meant to be used as a tool in order to see into how the mind works and what this so-called solid universe is really made of. And then this helps to free the mind from its misunderstandings about things. Thinking that impermanent things are permanent, thinking that suffering is happiness, thinking the things that aren't us are us. So without those distortions, if you will, in place, then the mind is free from both past associations and from attaching to things that are arising in the present. This is not something that we have to do. So I hope that you know, this doesn't come across as a new list of things that we need to think about, pay attention to, put on our to-do list. Rather, I hope it's just bringing to light somewhat of how this practice works, because I don't think it has to be a mystery. You know, if we go about our mindfulness practice and our insight contemplation, these things will take place. But it helps somehow, at least it helps for me, to hear how this process works, hear that this is the way the mind works. If these practices are done, this is what starts to unfold, and here's some examples of how that comes about. So this isn't a set of things to take on. It's a set of things that I hope will touch the part of your heart that wants to be free. So instead of thinking too much about all these words that I've said, let it settle into your heart and touch that part of you that wants freedom, however that freedom is going to look for you, and however it touches your heart to come here and to participate in these teachings. Yeah, there's so much value here, and it's so important that we share with each other the ways that it's working for us. So there's a few minutes left if people have comments or things you'd like to share about your wisdom, questions about insight practice. Anything coming to mind? Get a microphone so it's easier. shifting in your chair. Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
For me, I'm able to be concentrated and have a still mind, but I don't know when to start investigating.
Mm. When you have this stable and still mind, what is there in your mind? What's that feeling?
Just that my breathing is very quiet,
mm-hmm.
and my mind is still. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. It's
mm-hmm.
empty.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that comes up that I can investigate because it's empty.
Right. Okay. And when you come out of that, you know, like I ring the bell, sometimes kind of loudly, how does the mind emerge from that?
Then I kind of like, oops,
uh-huh.
back to
yeah,
looking
okay.
at you.
Okay. And it just feels like a sort of a normal transition to
right.
you.
Yes.
Okay. This sounds fine to me. In that your mind has found a quiet place, but when the conditions for that aren't there anymore, namely when the bell rings, you don't attach to it from your description. You know, you just, now your awareness is different. At this moment, your consciousness is different, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And if that's fine, then I don't think anything needs to change right now. But however, you are asking this question, so I have the sense that you're thinking that you should be investigating.
Yeah, because you said there's serenity and there's insight.
Mm-hmm.
I can be serene, but I don't have any insights.
You don't have the insights. Okay, well, one thing, if you're interested in starting some investigation in this kind of mind, one thing that people do is look for the qualities of the mind that are present in that very quiet state. Because even though there aren't thoughts, you've said there aren't thoughts, there's something there. There are conditions in the mind, there are qualities of the mind that are present when the mind is like that. And I'll offer a few that you can look for. One is the quality of the attention meeting the object. And the other is the quality of the attention staying with the object. So you're staying with the breath, or you're staying with even not the if the physical breath gets very quiet, there's still kind of a mental image of the breath, right? So there's the quality of being, of noticing that and staying with it. There may be a quality that's called joy, which is generally this may be subtle for you from what you've described, but. Also, or rapture. There's kind of a sense of delight in that the mind has gotten so quiet, essentially. More subtle than that is something called sukha, or happiness, which is a deeper, very quiet kind of contentment. That may be there. And there's also a quality, of the fifth quality I'm naming, there's only five, is a quality of one-pointedness. So you've chosen the breath as your object, it sounds like. So that means that there aren't other objects. And so there's actually a quality associated with that of having only one thing in the mind, and that has a feeling to it. So it's possible to observe. Classically, we observe those five things in the mind. And if you want to investigate, you can sort of see which one is stronger than the other at this moment. And I would suggest that your aim in doing that, it can be just to learn about these five qualities, but it could be to see which of them are the what's called the coarsest, you know, the difference between coarse and fine, like in sand. And so which of these are coarser and which are finer, and then have the aim to let go of the coarser ones. That's a lot of instruction that I've just given you, but that's kind of classic instruction for how to do concentration practice and how to start to investigate a little bit within concentration practice. I hope it's helpful.
Yeah, That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Yeah.
Yes, I found your talking very inspiring, very awakening, I should say. And but you were talking about attachments, and so right away, you know, the mind started to think, oh, this is the answer here. What she's saying is the answer. So right away I started to think, oh, I'm going to go home, and then I'm going to go on online, I'm going to download, listen to this talk again, and, you know, trying to get attached to that kind of feeling. So how have you separate that attachment to the Dharma, to the talk, to other attachments?
I hear what you're saying. This is a very important point. Actually, I'm very glad you asked that question, because we can sometimes think that any kind of desire or any kind of sense that we want to hold on to something is attachment, and that's bad, and we should let go of that immediately. I don't think so. In fact, the Buddha didn't even say that. The Buddha was very clear that one image he used is that of a raft. And so there's a river we need to cross. And, you know, we can't swim across it, for example, let's say. And so we gather up materials and we create a raft and we use that to cross the river. Now, that doesn't mean that we put the raft on our head and carry it on forever. Once we crossed the river, that raft served its purpose. But we had to have the raft. And you don't jump off the raft in the middle of the river either. That's not very wise. So this is an analogy for saying that it's fine to grasp onto teachings, to grasp onto the path, to connect with a teacher, to, you know, to do all kinds of things that are supportive for the longer-term purpose of letting go of the unwholesome attachments. I don't know if I can say this language, but I will. There are healthy attachments, in a sense. And so some of them include desire to become liberated. So if that desire is in your mind, then we hold on to the things that are relevant to the path. Desire to help others, so compassion, to serve in the world, that's a healthy desire, because that too can be a path to liberation for ourselves or for others. So these kinds of things. So you asked your question, though, at the very end. You said, how can we separate these two? And so I go back to the very most basic instruction of the Buddha, which said that if something on the path, something that seems to be appearing, is leading away from greed, hatred, and delusion, then that's a good path to follow. And if it's leading toward more greed, hatred, and delusion, it's not a good path to follow. You know, there's towards suffering and there's away from suffering, and we choose away from, even if it includes holding on to things and using things and having desires. So that's the criterion. Are you suffering less? And if this listening to this talk again is going to be good for your mind, then you should do it. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. That was a great point. Very important. Sometimes we can get a little too far on the non-attachment means letting go of everything right now. Okay, it's 11:05, so we'll stop. But thank you, everyone.